Welcome to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 15th, 2014. Scott Burton in the studio with you here on a Juno Afternoon. Today, professional screenwriter Sheila Jenkel will be here to tell us about a how-to workshop on screenwriting on Wednesday. Author Hannah Lindoff will be here to tell us about her new early reader book, Mary's Wild Winter Feast. And Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's Chuck Smythe and lecturer Victoria Wiley de Echeviera, hope I got that right, will be on the show to talk about a Tuesday lecture that will discuss how climate change is being perceived by indigenous people and how these changes are affecting cultural and biological diversity in the coastal environment of northwestern North America. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. Here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Attorneys have responded to the state of Alaska's proposed plan to address a court order involving translations of voting materials into Native languages before the November election. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
In a 30-page document, attorneys with the Native American Rights Fund asked for five main changes before Election Day. NARF attorney Natalie Landreth says the most important request is that the state have bilingual help for Native language voters in every community where it's needed.
You have to have a bilingual person in place in each village in advance of the election and on election day. That's number one.
The state has now offered the changes after a decision by a federal judge, Sharon Gleason, that the voter information brochures were inadequate under the Voting Rights Act. The state's proposal does not call for one bilingual person to be in each community where voters need help. The state does address additional written translations in their proposed plan. In the plaintiff's response brief, Landreth says the state must address dialect differences and get the word out about services. The state addresses dialect in their proposal, but suggests they would only confer with the plaintiff communities of Togiak and Hooper Bay. Attorneys are also requesting that posters be displayed in election places on Election Day. The state's plan includes use of posters. The state's plan also includes two teleconference training sessions, but attorneys for the plaintiffs say that in-person training for election workers is critical because of all the changes.
There needs to be an in-person training to show all of these new materials to those pre-election workers and teach them how to use them.
It's estimated that there are between 8 and 10,000 limited English proficient Yupik language voters and somewhere between 500 and 1,000 Gwich'in language voters in southwest and interior Alaska. Judge Gleason is expected to issue an order telling the state what they need to do soon. She has not yet ruled on whether the state intentionally violated voters' rights on the basis of race and color. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
In northern Wisconsin, the Lac des Flambeaux tribe is scheduled to start demolishing its historic Indian Bowl this week. WXPR's Natalie Jablonski reports.
The building dates back to the early 1950s. As Lac des Flambeaux tribal spokesperson Brandon Tomes explains, for years it drew tourists with its traditional dance performances and cultural events.
There's a lot of history that goes with the Indian Bowl. It was created in 1951. President Eisenhower was adopted into the band at the Indian Bowl in front of a large crowd, and it just has a real significance in our community.
Tom says the Indian Bowl was a crucial economic driver for the Lac des Flambeaux tribe in the years before the onset of Indian gaming, but over time it has fallen into disrepair, and now the tribe has a plan to demolish the structure and build a new arts center in its place. A fundraising campaign for the Waswaganing Indian Bowl Living Arts and Cultural Center hopes to raise more than $3.5 million to build the new facility, which organizers hope will be a cultural attraction for the entire region. The tribe held the final dance at the Indian Bowl powwow grounds this past weekend. For National Native News, I'm Natalie Jablonski.
The Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa plans to build a new heritage center in North Dakota. According to the Associated Press, the multi-million-dollar project will be located near the tribe's casino in Belcourt. The existing center is currently closed after falling into disrepair. The new one is expected to open next year. In Minnesota, Red Lake tribal leaders say they're working on relations with city officials The chairman and tribal council are traveling to Bemidji today to meet with the mayor and discuss concerns. Economic development and jobs are among topics. Ideas also include collaborating together to address health care crime and substance abuse. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org.
Not voting is not rebelling, it's surrendering. Your voice counts when you vote. First, you have to register. Find out more at nativevote.org. Brought to you by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 15th, 2014. Scott Burton, your host today. And now in the studio is professional screenwriter Sheila Jenka. And she's going to be telling us about a workshop on screenwriting on Wednesday. Welcome, Sheila.
Oh, thank you, Scott. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you here. And we were just chatting a little bit before the show started. First, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? You're a teacher. You're a writer. You live in L.A., but you have this fun connection with Juno. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I'll tell you, it is so easy to have a fun connection with Juno. We came up here for the first time back in May, and my husband and I just really fell in love with it. He really digs hiking, and I just love rain and the beautiful outdoors. And when I was here in May, you were having a spate of beautiful sunshine days, and they were saying, oh, it's so great, we've had this great weather for you. And I said, no, man, I was waiting for the cold, rainy weather. And they said, well, come back in the fall. So we did. And
it's not often you hear somebody from L.A. coming to Juneau for the weather.
Oh, man, I just love it. I love it here. And we flew in, and it was rainy and cold, and I love that. So love the weather, and I love the community here. I mean, I was very intrigued by the idea that you have, you know, in a community of 31,000 people, you have four independent bookstores. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we have four independent bookstores that I can think of readily in Los Angeles. I mean, they're just closing in droves, as we all know. And, you know, you just have such an appreciation here for the arts, and just love it. So, I mean, love the community. So it was really great to come back up here, and I really feel like, you know, feel like I belong here. And I'm finishing a book for my agent, and, it, you know, what a wonderful opportunity to come do it in a cold, rainy place. So we got on a plane and came to Alaska.
We should tell the Chamber of Commerce about this, how artists are starting to come here to spend studio time. You're going to write your second novel. Artists from all over America come to Juneau, Alaska.
Well, this is amazing. You know, Jack is amazing. 49 writers. We went to the Mudrooms event, you know, those women who started that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just so cool. There is so much here. I love it here. This is one of the most incredible places I've ever been. My husband and I are actually considering moving up here. I mean, we just really dig it.
Well, really cool. That's great to hear.
Yep.
But tell us a little bit about life in L.A. You're a teacher,
among other
things.
I teach part-time. I've done a little bit of university teaching. I taught at UCLA when I was doing my graduate degree there. I did an MFA in UCLA screenwriting, a very practical degree, as my daddy loved to tell me at the time. And I do some tutoring with kids, so any kind of reading and writing related stuff, and then teach part-time in a middle school. I teach a creative writing class through a charter school. I've taught in a private middle school as well, and I just love that age in particular. I mean, I just really dig, you know, middle school kids, you know, when they're just kind of at their angriest and smelliest and brattiest. I just really love teaching.
And how's teaching creative writing to them? Are they receptive?
Oh, they are so receptive. I really, really love it. They really love it, and it's very exciting because the principal is very progressive, again, in that it's a charter school. They have a little bit more flexibility, but I tend to bring in a lot of visiting instructors, and what I'm going to be doing when I get back is I'm bringing in firemen, I'm going to bring in a cop, I'm going to bring in an architect, I'm going to bring in a plumber. I'm going to bring people in to actually talk about what they do in their everyday job, and then the next meeting with the kids, they'll have to write a story or a poem or some kind of creative project with a person in that profession as the protagonist or antagonist of their story. Giving kids an opportunity to get exposed to something, but, you know, and just really step outside the bounds and learn about what great writing is. It is all about the verisimilitude and those little teeny tiny moments that we don't always get access to. You know, we learn about what a cap does watching television, and that's just not always how it goes. Not at all.
I like how you're bringing them into the studio, making it very real, a very practical situation for these young writers.
Sounds
like a good idea.
Oh, I love it.
And aside from that, down there, you went to UCLA Film School, is that right?
I did. So UCLA, it had a great, great experience. You know, there are a couple of great film schools in town, and UCLA is the state university, so it's a much smaller program, much more competitive, because everybody would rather pay, you know, $10,000 a year than $35,000 to go to USC across town. You know, another great film school. But I did my MFA in screenwriting at UCLA and just really loved it. I was able to be a teaching assistant there, have some wonderful professors there I continue to have great relationships with. And, you know, they're always very appreciative of my work. They'll read anything that I, you know, put across their desk. I actually was just in touch with one of my professors about an hour ago and trying to get him to come up here and check out Alaska. And he said he'll do it another time, but... Yeah, very cool. Loved UCLA.
All right, so that's another hat that you wear. You're also a novelist.
I am. I actually am on the second novel in a series. So I have a series of novels, and I landed a great agent, and am happy to say I got rejected by, you know, some of the best editors and publishing houses in New York. And, you know, and you just keep trying to, you know, get one out of the park. And we do actually have a very big editor who's very interested. She said, well, let me see the second one, you know. So I'm hard at work on the second novel in my series. And then also actually I'm just finishing the book that I'm finishing up here is actually a nonfiction book. So years ago when I had gone to Michigan State University and I moved to California, I worked as a nanny to pay back my student loans, and I did a lot of working for celebrities, traveling, different things like that, and loved all my kids, always loved the kids. But I remember in one job I was in, I would be taking these kids to school and they would always be arguing, these three beautiful girls. And so I started telling them stories, right? Because I'm a raconteur at heart, right? I dig storytelling. And we would get in the car the next day and the kids would say, pick up with the story. And I'd think, oy vey, where did I leave off in the story, right? And I'd start telling it and they'd say, that's not what the bear's name was. You said his name was Tommy. So I thought, scrap this. And I started telling them real stories from my life, and I called them lifetime stories because I always did a lot of wacky things and learned a lot of lessons on the way, and they loved it. So when I was at UCLA, there was a wonderful writer there, Carolyn C., who taught in the English department, and I got into one of her fiction classes, and I told her about this, and she read it, and she said, oh, Sheila, and she was a book reviewer for one of the big papers on the East Coast, and she said, I've never heard of anything like that. You need to finish that book. So finally got that book finished. It took me a little bit longer than I'd planned. But I've got 500 pages of it now, and this wonderful agent that I have said, well, we actually have two books here because there are stories that are appropriate for kids and some that are, you know, adult only. So it's just stories from my life. So it's a memoir, if you will, and then the lesson that I learned from them. So, it was a ball to write and just really cool. I'm very, very excited about that one, too.
Okay. Well, on Wednesday, though, you're not going to be talking about novel writing, although you may, who knows, talk about fiction. But, you did say memoir, so creative nonfiction, I should say.
Absolutely.
This is going to be about screenwriting.
It is indeed. It's, you know, classic screenwriting. And I've taught kids as young as 7 years old this very material we're covering, because once somebody's seen Cinderella, and kids have seen Cinderella, quite obviously, they understand the basic components of three-act structure as clarified to us by Aristotle, you know, 2,800 years ago. So it's wonderful, wonderful material. Can be appreciated by kids and adults alike. And it's really fun. I just really dig it. And I love teaching, and I love making people understand this. And it's really exciting, Scott, because the reality is we actually have three-act structure. It's in our DNA. It's not just certainly not just in movies, but it's in short stories, in novels. It's in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. It's in the Mona Lisa. I mean, three-act structure, literally, there is that flow. So it's really cool to learn about it.
Remind us basic three-act structure. What is it?
Yeah, well, it literally is acts 1, 2, and 3, and there are certain things that happen every time an act ends, and then as you are being propelled into the next act. The big thing to keep in mind in terms of three-act structure when we're talking about film is that movies move, right? And it's literally all about a character wanting something. One of the biggest complaints that I hear from studio execs when they bring a writer in to talk about their project is they don't hear what it is the character wants. Movies are all about somebody wanting something, right? E.T. wants to go home. Cinderella wants what every Disney character wants. She wants to marry the prince and live happily ever after, right? That's what stories are all about. Everything breaks down to what does a character want, and it's really important for you, the writer, we'll talk about this at length, to get very much in touch with what it is your character wants. And then, in contrast to what a character wants, you need to have an antagonist who's as strong as that character, who is going to be trying to keep them from getting what they want. So that's what the whole story is all about. That is the inherent conflict that must be present in any story. Somebody wants something, and somebody is adamantly committed to making sure they don't get it. That's storytelling.
So you'll be talking about that, I'm sure, on
yes.
Wednesday. What else can folks expect at the workshop?
Oh, well, we're going to talk about character background. It's a lot of fun to do character background stuff. And we're going to talk about outlining. Outlining is just the way you want to go. You want to make sure that you outline. You know, I mean, I paid $50,000 to get an education at UCLA so that I could see Academy Award-winning screenwriters come in time after time and all say the same thing, right? You've got to outline your screenplay, right? So getting clear about what that means to put those foundation poles in place. You know, that's the left brain part of the work, right? So we have left brain and right brain for creative writing, right? And the reality is most people want to skip that left brain stuff, and you're just not doing yourself any favor, right? You're not. My deal is I always teach kids, no matter what I'm teaching them, analytical or creative writing, you want to work smarter, not harder. And smarter is about get clear about what it is you're writing about and then sit down and play. So we're going to talk about very, very specifically like the 8 tent poles you need to have in place for a story structure, but then we're going to play around with character. But we got to make sure foundationally that we know what story we're telling, right? I mean, you wouldn't put up a tent without having the tent poles in place, yes?
That's right.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Wednesday at the Nugget Mall from 5:30 to 7:30.
Yes.
Where at the Nugget Mall do you happen to know? Is there?
Oh, I'm afraid that information I don't, but it's on their website.
You'll find
it.
Yeah,
and called Brenda and her wonderful people over there.
Nugget. Oh, at the Nugget Mall Hearthside, I bet.
Indeed.
Is that the bookstore?
Oh, forgive me. Yes.
Excuse me.
It's most definitely at the Hearthside bookstore.
And yeah.
I've been in touch with Brenda and Lizzie. They've been so helpful. Great people.
Sounds good.
Over
there. It's free, right?
It is free. Yes. And I just was talking because I was in contact with some of the schools too, making sure they have the information about this. And one very zealous receptionist answering the phone, she said, "Now, is this some kind of a deal where people come and then there's something where they have to pay later?" Absolutely not, right? This is for fun and for free. We're just going to play together and storytell. Yeah, it's going to be a real gas. And the cool thing is the rules for analytical writing and creative writing are exactly the same thing, right? You're always doing two things. In every line of writing, there is always two things, right? You're giving a piece of information, and you're creating a question. And all you do in the next line is you answer that question. That's all that goes on. So we're going to break down some really foundational stuff, which is really cool for kids in terms of, you know, potentially helping you with analytical writing. But if nothing else, even just in terms of getting that creative spark going. And that's the thing that I would want to make sure, Scott, is I've been saying to people, oh, are you a writer type? And a lot of times they say no. You know what? Come anyway.
Mm.
It's just great to get that creative spark going. It really is. And I'm a fun teacher, and we're going to have fun in class.
And what's your target audience age-wise?
Oh, you know what? I mean, originally this was kind of an adult's thing, but I thought about it and just remembered. I mean, as I said, I've taught in after-school programs and stuff, and kids just love it. So there is no target age. I mean, I'm expecting the bulk of our audience is probably going to be adults, but if elementary school kids want to come, if middle schoolers, high schoolers, whoever wants to come, we are going to be learning about classic 3-act structure, and it's material that's accessible to anybody. Again, we're breaking down Cinderella. We all know that one, right?
Well, Sheila, it sounds like a lot of fun. So that's this Wednesday, September 17th, from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Nugget Mall Hearthside Books.
Right.
Are we missing anything? Anything you'd like to add?
The only thing I wanted to throw out is I have been working on a reality show that it looks like it's going forward. This is wild.
Yeah.
It's a positive reality show, which is why it took so long to sell. Yeah. But my best friend growing up, we were best friends from kindergarten. She had always wanted to start a pie shop, so she did that about 10 years ago. And she, she had the great life, you know, beautiful girl, married the homecoming king, you know, homecoming queen daughters. I mean, she just had this great life. But she suffers from horrendous clinical depression and has. I mean, really serious depression. So despite the fact she has been very, very successful with her store, she has 3 stores in Michigan now, and she does press all over the country. She's done, you know, all kinds of, you know, Today Show, all kinds of things. I mean, she's very, very successful, but she, again, suffers from this horrendous clinical depression. And she will be in the bakery at 4 o'clock in the morning, because that's what you do when you have a bakery, and she's rolling pie dough, and she's sobbing, literally. They joke in the bakery that that's what makes the pie crust so good. But she took a cognitive and a behavioral approach to dealing with depression. So it's kind of a lifestyle show, if you will, but we will also be looking in a very intense, deep way at clinical depression and kind of some alternative ways to dealing with depression and just that whole thing, Scott, that you never know what's going on in anybody's life. You just don't.
And you're producing that down in Los Angeles?
I'm actually co-creating that, yeah. Well, we'll actually be shooting it because she's in the Midwest, right? And it's a reality show, right? What a joke. But, I mean, it is and it isn't. I mean, reality's funny. I was on a reality show years ago on HBO when I was in a big Project Greenlight thing, and reality shows are just kind of funny. But you know, so we'll certainly be shooting it in Michigan, and then, you know, we'd be editing and doing all that stuff in Los Angeles. Right. So that'll be fun, too. So there's a lot to talk about tomorrow night.
Yeah, and if you want to find out more about the reality show, screenwriting, or anything that we covered today, you should go see Sheila on Wednesday night, 5:30 to 7:30 at the Nugget Mall. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, Scott, thank you. It was really a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me here.
You're welcome.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big star out of me. We'll make a film about a man that's sad and lonely. And all I gotta do is act naturally. Well, I'll bet you I'm gonna be a big star. Might win an Oscar, you can't never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star. Cause I can play the part so well. Well, I hope you come to see me in the movie. And I know that you will plainly see. Biggest fool that's ever hit the big time. And all I gotta do is act naturally. We'll make the scene about a man that's sad and lonely. And begging down upon his bended knee. I'll play the part, but I won't need rehearsing. All I'll have to do is act naturally. Well, I'll bet you I'm gonna be a big star. Might win an Oscar, you can't never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star. Cause I can play the part so well. Well, I hope you come see me in the movie. And then I know that you will plainly see. The biggest fool that's ever hit the big time. And all I gotta do is act naturally.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 15th, 2014. Scott Burton with the studio here on A Juno Afternoon. And with me now in the studio is Hannah Lindoff. Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you. And you are the author of a new early reader book called Mary's Wild Winter Feast.
Yes, that's right.
All right. So tell me a little bit about yourself. You're from Juneau, right?
Yes, I'm from Juneau. I live here with my husband, who is from Hoonah, and we have our 2 kids growing up here in Juneau.
Okay. And you're a writer, obviously. You know, what I like to do a lot of times when I have a writer in the studio is just start off with a selection. Do you have something you can read out of the book?
I do, and so I'll just preface it a little bit for you. This book is an early reader book, so it's broken up into several different chapters. And the overall conceit of the book is that on a really bad Juno winter day, which I think we all know what those are like, a daughter is complaining to her father about living here, and he takes her to the kitchen, and they look at all the different jars of food that they harvested throughout the year and recount those adventures. So I thought that I would look at the chapter for smoked salmon because that is something that is being harvested now, is some salmon.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Daddy held up a half-pint jar filled with red strips. Do you know what this is? It's salmon again. Not just salmon, Little Bear. It's smoked sockeye, the best salmon in the world. It tastes sweet, but not too sweet. It tastes salty, but not too salty. It's rich and smoky and perfect. Last fall, I went fishing with Uncle Boots. We wanted to make one more salmon harvest before the season. We started my boat in the darkness before the sun rose. Fallen leaves turned the air musty. I felt autumn in the cool weather. Luckily, it didn't take long to get to the creek. This time we cast netted. I rolled up the net, and then I threw it where I saw a salmon. Splash. I hit a rock. I rolled it up and threw it again. Splash. I pulled the net in, but it was empty. Splash. I caught a stick. At last I got the hang of it. Splash, I got a salmon. And after that, almost every splash brought me a fish. When you brought it home, I helped you smoke it, said Mary proudly. Yes, I love having a good helper like you, said Daddy. We lit a fire in the smokehouse and hung the salmon on the racks. The salmon came up and lent its flavor to the fish. Then you cut up the salmon and I put it in the jars, Mary remembered. Yes, Daddy said. We put oil in the jars to make the sockeye soft and good for eating with crackers. Mmm, Daddy, I found the crackers, said Mary.
Well, thanks for reading that. Among other things I like, I think sometimes for a kid you just assume that they know what smoked salmon is, but this actually takes them through the whole process.
Right, yeah. The whole idea is that, you know, these things that you're eating and that we have available to us really are adventures and have great stories behind them oftentimes.
Absolutely. How long have you been writing?
Well, this project I started about 2.5 years ago, but I don't know how to quantify that. I feel like it's something I've always done.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And have you always written for children, nonfiction, fiction?
Well, no, I don't know. I wrote this for my daughter. Her name, we call her Mary. And, you know, this is really a story that reflects the way things are in our family and in our house.
Sounds like that would be a fun project, being able to write a story for your daughter and being able to read it to her along the way, maybe check in on her with it and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And, you know, she is very proud of this book. It's her book, really. It's not mine.
That's great. What were some challenges for you as you wrote and produced this?
Well, you know, so this book, we worked through the University of Alaska Press, and they don't have a, you know, expansive catalog of children's books. And one thing that I had to do, which is not always the case for a writer, is that I had to find my own illustrator. And we really wanted to have a Tlingit illustrator because, well, my husband's Tlingit, and a lot of the story has, you know, a theme that is applicable, and it is really an homage to this land that we live in, which is, you know, Tlingit territory. So it made sense in a lot of ways. And so, but that is very specialized, and so I had to find, you know, somebody. And the funny thing is that I actually got my first choice. I really wanted to work with Clarissa Rizzo. I just thought she was so famous that she wouldn't be interested. So I really asked around a lot before I came to her. And but she is more of a fine artist. And what we ended up doing is that she made these collages based on, she read the text and created these beautiful collages based on the stories. and then Nobu Koch, who's also from here in Juneau, put them more into an illustration form, and mm-hmm. so it became this hybrid between an illustration and the more fine art concept of the collage.
So I bet that was a fun collaboration as well.
Very fun, because, you know, by then my work was done, and I just kind of got to oversee it, and I would sketch things out on, like, a crayon and make it happen, and, you know, and it came out 100 times more beautiful than I could have ever imagined, so that was pretty fun.
You said you've been writing for a long time. Was it a challenge to write for a children's audience?
Yes. And, you know, I have two small kids. I had one at the time when I wrote this. But you think that you understand, you know, kind of how a children's book works, but really you're not looking at, like, the fundamentals of, like, how long the paragraphs are, how long the sentences are. So I had to basically rewrite the whole thing after doing some research and looking at other early reader books. At first I had the idea that it would make a good picture book, and the editor said, you know, it's really way too long, but this would make an awesome early reader. And so then I, you know, I hadn't really thought of how to write an early reader, but, you know, with a little research, it came together.
And speaking of early reader, what would you say is your target audience for this?
So for a kid who is reading on their own, you know, it would, you know, like 6 to 9, it isn't, or maybe even 10, it is in chapters. I'm going to read it I've read it at the Celebration story time at the library that we did during Celebration. And then, I'm going to read it again on Thursday, this week, Thursday at 5:30 at the Valley Library. And it is a read aloud book too. So, you know, I would say, you know, three to five read aloud book, and then you know, more like 6 to 9 read it on your own book.
Okay, and if somebody wanted to get it, where should they go?
Well, they can come to the library for story time, or not story time, the family night is what they call it, family night at 5:30 on Thursday, and Hearthside will have them available. It's also available through Hearthside anytime, and then we are also going to do in October the first Friday downtown Hearthside. Nobu Koch will be here, and she and I are both going to do a signing.
Okay, so this Thursday at the Valley Library for family time at 5:30,
yes.
And then October 1st Friday?
Yes.
At Hearthside?
That's right.
Downtown. That sounds great. Hannah Lindoff, thank you for your time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 15th of September, 2014. It's the birthday of Robert Benchley, born Worcester, Massachusetts, 1889, went to Harvard, wrote for the Lampoon, went to New York, became a freelance writer, struggled for years, became managing editor of Vanity Fair, met Dorothy Parker and Robert Sherwood, and the three of them would go to lunch together at the Algonquin Hotel, and that's the beginning of the Algonquin Round Table. Worked as a drama critic for about 9 years, contributed to the New Yorker magazine, published more than 600 humorous essays, and in the 1930s went to Hollywood, worked on screenplays, made some short comic films, and began drinking heavily. Robert Benchley, who once said, "I know I'm drinking myself to a slow death, but then I'm in no hurry." And he did die of cirrhosis of the liver at the age of 56. It's the birthday of Agatha Christie, born in Torquay, England, 1890. She worked in a hospital dispensary, so she knew something about pharmaceuticals and poisons, which served her well as the author of more than 70 murder mysteries, including Murder on the Orient Express, Death on the Nile, and her play The Mousetrap, which has been running continuously on the West End since 1952. It's the birthday of the physicist Murray Gell-Mann, born in New York City, 1929, child prodigy, went to Yale, the age of 15, earned his Ph.D. from physics from MIT, researched subatomic particles in the 50s and 60s, developed a way to categorize composite particles known as hadrons into 8 separate types. And smaller particles he christened quarks, a name he got from a line in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, 3 quarks for Muster Mark. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1969. Murray Gell-Mann, who's been called the man with 5 brains, because in addition to his work in physics, he's helped to organize an environmental studies program. He's an expert on historical linguistics in his spare time, a rancher, a bird watcher, and a collector of antiquities. And it's the birthday of the first American novelist, James Fenimore Cooper, born Burlington, New Jersey, 1789. Grew up in Cooperstown, New York, town that his father founded, ran wild in the woods, went to Yale, was expelled, and became a novelist, best known for the Leatherstocking Tales, novels starring the frontiersman Natty Bumppo, a series that includes The Last of the Mohicans, made into a movie several times. Here's a poem for today by Edwin Romond, One Good Thing. It's been a dead parade of hours since 5 a.m., a march of the bland with the meaningless, and I can think of nothing I have done to merit mentioning or remembering. But now, at 8 p.m., I am bathing my son in a tub filled with bubbles and blue battleships. The soapy water over his Irish white skin makes him glisten like a glazed donut. And I should tell him to stop splashing, but this is the first time all day I have felt like living, so how can I scold my boy who's found joy in something ordinary as water? And when I wash his hair with Buzz Lightyear shampoo, Liam closes his eyes and smiles like a puppy being petted as I massage the sweet lotion into his red curls. And I know this is one good thing I have done with my life, this day that has waited for this moment of water on my sleeve and soap on my nose to turn emptiness into ecstasy. One Good Thing, a poem by Edwin Romond, used by permission of the poet here on The Writer's Almanac. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
After a successful pilot season of Writer Showcase, 360 North and K2 would like to re-invite Alaska writers to participate in the 2014-2015 season. We'll record our first episode on November 13th, and we're looking for short stories and creative nonfiction that revolve around the holidays, Thanksgiving included. Pieces should be about 10 minutes long when read aloud and be in by October 5th. Please send your work, ideas, or questions to arts@ktoo.org. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 15th, 2014. Scott Burton in the studio. And with me now is the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's Chuck Smythe. Welcome, Chuck.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. Let me turn your microphone on right there, and I'm going to see if I can get it right, Victoria. Victoria Wiley de Echeverria.
Close.
Will you correct me, please?
Wiley de Echeverria.
Well, thank you. It's nice having you in the studio as well, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, Chuck, let's start with you. You work at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do there and the program that's brought Victoria to us?
Sure. We do a variety of programs in history, culture, language, and arts. And one of them is a visiting scholar program that supports and facilitates PhD students and scholars coming to SHI and use the archives, the history, the photographs and the language recordings and the archival manuscripts and book collection. And we facilitate their visit here by providing logistical support access to those collections and helping them proceed in their work.
Mm.
You know, and so she came over as a visiting scholar from Oxford University. And she's giving a lecture tomorrow, which I hope we'll get to a little later in the program.
Absolutely, at noon tomorrow. We'll get to that for sure. And how did you two find each other? How did you find Victoria? How'd that work?
Well, through her advisor, who's Tom Thornton, who's a long association with us and with Southeast Alaska for, 25 years?
Yeah.
Okay. Victoria, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from and how you got into this field?
Okay. So I live in Victoria, British Columbia, and I did my undergraduate and my master's at the University of Victoria with a world-famous ethnobotanist named Nancy Turner, who's worked throughout B.C. and parts of Alaska as well for over 40 years. And working with her, I got very interested, well, before even working with her in high school, I was very interested in learning about how people use plants in their daily lives, mostly wild plants and people that have close connections to their landscapes. So throughout undergrad and master's, I worked on this, and then I got the opportunity to go to the University of Oxford and work under Tom Thornton. And I've expanded a little bit, so I kind of work a bit more on ethnoecology now, which is people's connections to their landscape and how they live in that, manipulate it, manage it, harvest from it, all of that. So that's what I'm studying now.
How's it going?
It's going pretty well. I'm in the first year of my program, so I only had one class at Oxford. I finished that, and I'm here in the middle of my field season.
Great. Well, welcome to Juneau. And how's that going for you? You say in the middle of the season, so how long have you been in Juneau now?
I've been in Juneau for a month, just over a month, and I'm here in Juneau for another few days. I go down to Ketchikan and Prince of Wales Island for about a week to talk to people there, and then over to British Columbia in Canada because my study is kind of transboundary and looking at the Tlingit, Tsimshian, and Haida peoples from southeast all the way down to into British Columbia.
I like the definition, northwestern North America.
Yes.
And may I ask, what are some of your first impressions of Juneau, or, you know, our rainforest here in southeast?
Yeah, well, luckily I've had a few sunny days. There's been a lot of rain.
Right.
But the sunny days have been spectacular and gorgeous, and I've gone up to the Herbert Glacier and Mendenhall Glacier, which has been great. I got to spend a week in Hoonah and Cake doing interviews, so that's been really fascinating, going on the ferry. I love just being able to relax on the ferry, not have internet, just
so nice.
Soak it up.
Like a train on the water kind
of,
right? Okay. And I was just thinking of where you're from, the San Juan area down there. What are some differences that you've noticed? I know some people were considered part of the same rainforest, right? It sort of starts up in South Central and goes to Northern California. We're the same rainforest, but there's some differences. What are some differences you've noticed?
Yeah, well, definitely still a rainforest. It rains a lot at home. It rains a lot here. One of the things I think of is it just gets craggier up here. Everything just seems, the mountains seem a bit steeper. You know, I don't know. It just seems a little bit more craggier, yeah. But at home, things are a little bit not quite as steep, not quite as,
More like Ketchikan.
Yeah.
But it's fun, you know, moving up and down the coast from here. I lived in Fairbanks for a couple of years when I was quite small, so I don't remember much, but I really enjoy being on the water.
All right. Coastal. And it sounds like you've had a chance to go, you said Cake and Hoonah?
I went to Cake and Hoonah.
Interviews, and I don't ask you too much about those because I'm sure that's what you'll be talking about tomorrow. Is it tomorrow at noon?
Yes.
Yeah, tomorrow at noon. But what are a few things that you've started to glean from your conversations with folks about climate change?
Yeah, well, it's hard to really put my finger on too much yet because I still have so much interviews floating around in my head. But people are seeing changes of some kind. Snow's been mentioned a lot. The fact that there was really heavy snows when people were much younger. There have been some heavy snows recently too, so maybe, I don't know, looking at that. I'm interested in looking at some weather data as well to kind of track the snow depths. Also, the glacier retreating is a big deal here. Those kind of observations will not be as frequent down in Haida Gwaii because the glaciers aren't the same. They don't come down in the water as far. So the glaciers and the static rebound is a big thing. Looking at the tidal changes and the weather, water coming up, temperature has been a big deal, water temperature and air temperature, changing seasons, not having definitive seasons as much. Things are kind of blending into each other a bit more.
Okay, so, interesting observations. And so you'll be giving a talk tomorrow at noon. Mm-hmm. Over in the Sea Alaska building?
Yes, in the boardroom on the fourth floor.
Okay.
And people are invited to bring their lunch if they'd like.
Nice.
It's during the lunch hour.
And how long do you expect it should go?
An hour.
About an hour? Okay.
Yeah, with questions.
Yeah, there'll be time for some discussion. I'd love to get input from whoever shows up.
Great. Well, I'm sure people will be interested and go. Again, this is at noon tomorrow. Is there anything else that either of you would like to add?
I think that's it.
All right. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See ya.
Bye.
This is Bird Note. Today, we're walking the shoreline of a saltwater bay. The tide's going out, revealing a broad expanse of dark, glistening mudflat. This muddy plain might appear a waste of natural space, a mere transient landscape awaiting the rising tide. And that low tide smell! On a hot day, it goes right by pungent, heading for malodorous. But that mudflat fragrance offers an important clue. Mudflats are rich in nutrients, such as decomposing organic matter and minerals. Mudflats, far from wastelands, support a bounty of life, such as foraging sandpipers, called dunlin. Much of this life lies below the surface. Scoop up a pail of mud, and you might find, in addition to a clam or two big enough to eat, vast quantities of tiny snails and clams, worms, crustaceans, larvae, and much more. Mudflats also support a bounty of bird life. Millions of shorebirds follow shorelines and their mudflats each spring and fall, where they feast upon those tiny creatures hidden beneath the mud surface, a banquet that powers the birds' continent-spanning migrations. So the next time you wrinkle your nose at low tide, imagine the countless creatures that draw their lifeblood from that fragrant mudflat. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Hi, my name is Phil Paramore. I host Sound Means on Monday mornings at 10 a.m. on KRNN. I appreciate KRNN Radio because it's fun, it's fresh, it's entertaining, and it's informative. Tune in to KRNN 102.7 FM. Thanks.
A fine show there produced by Phil Paramore over on KRNN. And that's my three guests for the today, and I have some little extra time here. And we often get new music in the studio, and one that I just noticed is a musician who played at Northern Light United Church last year, Kahalen Morrison. He played there with Eli West. It was a really fun concert. And his new CD is called Country Hammer. So here's a track off that called Nighttime is Here on the Valley.
Nighttime is here on the valley. Nighttime is here on the floor. They whistle and they cheer and they guzzle their beer. Oh, nighttime is here on the valley. Nighttime done settled. And the bright lights keep on burning, a hole in the ground. Oh, the bright lights burn the rodeo down. The salt flats lie still over the mountain.
Slow the mountains washed with the weather and with time. They whistle and they cheer, quickly bury the fear, for the nighttime is here on the valley. Oh, the nighttime done settled over the plain. The sash has been sewn and the queen stands a singing, one hand on her heart, one thumb in her crown. Oh, the bright lights burn the rodeo down. In the corner of the kingdom, the gate stays just a swaying in time. They whistle and they cheer for God's blood, rope, and steer. For the nighttime is here on the valley. Oh, the nighttime done settled over the plain. Money's half bad. The bright lights keep on burning, a hole in the ground. Oh, the bright lights burn the rodeo down. The bright lights burn the rodeo down.
Do you have questions for Juneau's municipal candidates? You can ask them at a Juneau Votes Forum on September 17th, noon to 1:30 p.m. at the University of Alaska Southeast Egan Lecture Hall. Submit your questions in advance to junovotes@gmail.com. A Juneau Votes moderator will choose the best questions to be asked of candidates for Juneau Assembly and School Board. This forum is being produced in partnership with the Juneau Empire and KTOO. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 15th, 2014. Tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon, we'll hear about the upcoming Roaring Twenties Soiree fundraiser. We'll profile the Capital City Rescue Department with Chief Rick Etheridge. We'll get the details about Perseverance Theater's current production of An Iliad. Terry Calvin from the Career and College Center at both TMHS and JDHS will be here to talk about junior and senior information nights and financial aid nights at the schools. There's also an open forum about Juno schools with Superintendent Mark Miller on Thursday, 9:18 at 6 p.m. We'll hear all about that. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more tomorrow here on KTOO News. Also tonight at 7 on Peace Talk, the program that will be about the 51-day war between Israel and Gaza that includes interviews with Naomi Dan of Jewish Voice for Peace and Haitham Mohana, a 16-year-old Palestinian boy who spent last year attending Haines High School and returned to Gaza just before the war broke out, with your host, Rich Moniak. Weather for tonight's cloudy, slight chance of rain with some light winds. Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain in the morning, light winds. Wednesday, mostly cloudy, chance of rain, light winds again. And Thursday, it looks like rain is likely, highs around 55. Saturday through Sunday, going into next weekend, rain likely, highs around 54 and lows around 58.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juno, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks again for tuning in. Stay tuned. In about a minute, we'll go to All Things Considered.
Hi, this is Rob Cohen, and I'm excited to be kicking off 360 North's concert series, Alaska Originals, with the Rob Cohen Jazz Group. Join me, Doug Bridges on sax, Alexi Painter on bass, and Clay Good on drums for a show we're calling Contrafaction. Music, conversation, and more at 360 in the KTOO building. Thursday, September 25th. Doors open at 6:30 and cameras roll at 7 sharp. Tickets at krnn.org.
Not they're going to get Ebola, it's they're going to have chest pain or they're going to have a headache, and we no longer have our accredited medical service provider in the capitals that are able to do that.
Airlines have stopped flying to West African countries plagued by Ebola.
For Monday, September 15th, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The action of the airlines has slowed relief efforts in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea.
Also, is the Ebola virus likely to mutate and become airborne?
I don't know of any human virus.